Irreverent novelist Christopher Moore's new book centers on the thankless task of shepherding the souls of the newly dead. The obligation falls on the owner of a secondhand store in San Francisco, along with an instruction manual, the Great Big Book of Death, which explains it's a dirty job, but somebody has to do it. Before we get to the climactic battle between the forces of darkness and the forces of light, light has some pretty peculiar allies, by the way. Moore expounds on karma, hellhounds, and the lethal qualities of the 1958 Cadillac Eldorado. If you have questions for the author of Lamb, Practical Demon Keeping, and The Stupidest Angel, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. Christopher Moore's new book is titled A Dirty Job. The author joins us now from the studios of member station KQED in San Francisco. Nice to talk to you again.
Hi, Neil. How you doing?
I'm doing well. We've been talking to people about sure signs of spring. I wonder what for you denotes the change of the seasons there in San Francisco.
Well, I'm living in Hawaii now, and basically it's just the sunscreen goes from SPF 15 to 30 when it's spring. That's the only difference you notice.
You do notice that, of course, we hate you.
Yeah, well, don't be too jealous. It's been raining for 35 days straight in the North Shore of Kauai, where I live.
That quick description I had of your new book skips over, which is one of its what I think is one of its central attractions, which is an extended discourse on the nature of the beta male. And let me read an excerpt from your book. While alpha males are often gifted with superior physical attributes, size, strength, speed, good looks, selected by evolution over the eons by the strongest surviving and essentially getting all the girls, the beta male gene has survived not by meeting and overcoming adversity, but by anticipating and avoiding it. Thus, when the alpha males are out charging after mastodons, the beta males could imagine in advance that attacking what was essentially an angry, woolly bulldozer with a pointy stick might be a losing proposition, so they hung back at camp to console the grieving widows.
Absolutely. I think beta males on evolutionary basis are much more successful than the alpha males are. You don't hear much about us, but there's a lot more of us out there.
So you count yourself among the beta male
absolutely.
Community?
Absolutely. My theory, I was very fortunate when I was searching for the term beta male among humans that nobody had seemed to really define it. And so I was able to do that. And the way I ended up defining it was saying that, you know, while the alpha males may have evolved all these other attributes, what beta males got was an imagination. And if there's, and since I make my living basically with my imagination, I have to count myself among the betas.
Mm-hmm. Your hero in this book, Charlie Asher, I guess could be classified as a classic beta male who got lucky once in his life and fears that he never will again.
Pretty much. He's archetypically a beta male in that his imagination, much like saber-toothed tiger's teeth, are no longer – it's no longer really required for survival. So he's become a little bit neurotic and is almost a hypochondriac, and he applies this – he projects this onto his wife and his new baby girl. And that's sort of it typifies, I think, the beta male in the modern world, in that we really don't need to anticipate the dangers that we may have needed to in the Paleolithic period. But now we can apply those things to video games and hypochondria.
And while Charlie is your classic beta male, in the end, he succumbs to, heroic tendencies.
Yeah, I don't know really how that happened other than I needed to have an end for the book. But there was a call to action, I think, and Charlie, the entire book is sort of Charlie being, by being personified as death, he sort of has to learn that you have to live and you can't be afraid of life or death. And so that sort of permeates the entire book. And one of the reasons that I wrote it in the first place was to sort of not be irreverent about death, but to sort of defang the fear of death, which I think almost paralyzes people at points.
I do have to ask you, I mean, it's a very funny book. You're a very funny writer, but you dedicate the book to hospice workers. You have a scene, again, a very moving scene where Charlie's mother dies. And was there a death of someone close to you?
Absolutely. I was the primary caretaker for my own mother during the last 5 months of her death and spent a lot of time sharing her care with hospice workers. And then my wife, late girlfriend's mother, passed. And I was secondary, sort of the backup caretaker for her mom. And so I experienced two fairly close deaths in the family and was right there to observe what was going on around the care for the people with the dying and with the people who were reacting to it. And that really is what inspired doing the whole book in the first place.
Mm-hmm. there's a strange supposition that people deposit their souls somehow into objects, which, of course, these agents of karma like Charlie have to collect before the forces of evil can get them.
Yeah, it was sort of, I thought it was the ultimate irony. I think we've talked before that I think irony is the most powerful force in the universe. And I thought it was great to take this the most spiritual of all objects, if you will, the soul, mm-hmm. and attach it to the material. I just thought it would be funny to do that. And consequently, it becomes the mechanism by which we go from one body to the next, or from one incarnation to the next, is through your favorite CD or your favorite vase for your flowers or whatever.
Whatever it was that mattered.
Whatever it was that you attached your soul to, and I just thought it was a great irony to use that as the mechanism for reincarnation, basically.
Yet you find time amidst this spiritual explanation to take us through the progression of strippers' names. Back to the 50s, Bubbles, Boom Boom, and Blaze begat Bambi, Candy, and Jewel, who begat Sunshine, Brandy, and Cinnamon, who begat Amber, Brittany, and Bree, who begat Reagan, Morgan, and Madison. Madison is a stripper name.
All that comes from Ray, who is an ex-cop, an injured cop, who is another beta male and has entirely too much time on his hands. So he's able to think about things like the etymology of stripper names. And Ray is one of the people that works in Charlie's secondhand store and basically through most of the book thinks that Charlie might be a serial killer. And Charlie, on the other hand, also thinks Ray might be a serial killer just because they're suspicious by their natures and have a little more imagination than is really healthy for them.
And there's another character who works at the secondhand store, Lily, a goth girl. I kept seeing the actress Pauly Perrette, who's currently in NCIS. She might be a little old for the part, but that's who I kept seeing.
Well, I think that there's the thing that I had to bring that goth culture in, because these are people who sort of they really have a great sense of humor about the morbid, and so it was great to bring in this intelligent kid basically who had thought out all of the morbid things in advance and sort of glorified death in a real sort of rock star way, and then have Charlie, who was this paranoiac basically, who gets the job of being death, be, you know, she would be a great foil for him. So she gets actually a lot of the best lines in the whole book.
Indeed. And she's severely disappointed, for example, that Charlie, the beta male, gets this really cool job.
Yeah, when she has the wardrobe for it, basically, is what she says to him. And she says something, I believe the phrase is, "You can't be all horny for the grave. I've got the wardrobe for it." And she's a lot of fun. She was great to write. And the next book I'm writing, her best friend is one of the characters in it.
Let's get some callers in on this. Our guest is Christopher Moore, author of 9 novels. The most recent is A Dirty Job. You may know him from Lamb and The Stupidest Angel. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. Email talk@npr.org. And Gordon is with us. Gordon calling from Panama City.
Hi, Gordon.
Yeah, hi. How you doing, Christopher?
Great, thank you.
I love your books. I bought one, and I love that I went back and bought every single one of them. I read all your books in probably 4 weeks.
We like to hear that. Thank you so much.
A blast. My question was, are there going to be any returning characters from some of your other books? If I remember correctly, there were some crossover characters on some of the books.
Actually, there are, and especially because this one's set in San Francisco, and my previous novel, Bloodsucking Fiends, A Love Story, was set in San Francisco. Uh-huh. The character of the Emperor, who is the Emperor of San Francisco and Alta California and protector of Mexico, a homeless guy who is based on a real historical character, Joshua Norton, returns and is in this book. And Jody, my vampire from Bloodsucking Fiends, does a walk-on, although she's not named. And then one of the death dealers, or agents of karma, as Neil referred to them, is Minty Fresh, is from my book Coyote Blue, which was my my book about Crow Indians that I wrote back in 91. And so there are some – I don't think that you have to have read all those other books to appreciate it, but those people like yourself who have read the other ones are probably going to have a lot of fun when you run across these different characters. Inspector Rivera is a homicide inspector in the book, and he's appeared, I think, in 5 of my novels.
Mm-hmm. And gets a new career at the end.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. One he well deserves.
And the Minty Fresh, this is a 7-foot-tall black man who does not play basketball, owns a used record store in San Francisco. There's this wonderful scene where he hits his head on a short doorway and begins, as you explained in the book, to begin to look like a Klingon warrior, except for the minty green suit. Well, maybe the Klingon warrior's agent.
Exactly. Minty Fresh was – he was thrown out of – he played college ball but was thrown off the team for an attitude problem. And his name – his mother was one of the very first Crest toothpaste test people, and so she named all of her children after dental hygiene catchphrases. And one of his sisters is named after Flossie, the dental flossing cow. And he becomes Minty Fresh after that sort of cliche flavor we all get after just being brushed. And it was – I had had a lot of requests to bring Minty back because he had a very small part in my book, Coyote Blue. And it was perfect. I wanted this image of this very tall black man who sort of just – played to his own drummer, and there it was. You know, sometimes you have these characters laying around doing nothing, and you think, I think I'll put him to work, and that was the case with Minty Fresh.
Gordon, thanks very much for the call. Our guest today is Christopher Moore. His new book is A Dirty Job, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's get another caller on the line. This is Bob. Bob's with us from Chicago.
TFTMC, and thank you so much for allowing us to speak with you, Christopher. You're so pleasantly twisted. I don't know what you're on, but I'd love to find a couple dollars worth. The question is regarding Lamb. Did you get major grief from that? And has anyone expressed an interest in putting it on the big screen?
Well, you know, I really thought as I was writing it, my family was worried for me because, you know, Lamb, as you know, is the humorous retelling of the untold years of Christ's life.
The retelling of which is always welcomed by those to whom it matters so much.
Indeed.
Well, exactly. And I really thought that there was going to be a lot of fervor over it and, you know, there would be a fatwa put out on me. And then it didn't happen. The people, the faithful were writing to me saying, I love this. It renewed my faith. And I was getting, I still do. It's a huge hit among seminarians because I guess now their education's relevant to two books. But there were ministers who wanted to use it in church, and I thought this totally backfired on me because when we originally published it, you know, we were sending it to you know, Falwell and Swaggart, and with notes saying, "Can you believe this blasphemer?" And you know, by the end of the third month it was out, I was calling you know, my old friends in Ohio saying, "Look, I'll buy the books if you'll burn them." But we couldn't get any negative reaction at all to Lamb, and I think the great thing about that was that people got it. They got the idea that it was not an attack book. It was simply trying to show that, you know, there's probably been a sense of humor around in the world since people have been around, and that's all I did was apply that to that story.
Well, it's all great stuff. I'm heading out to the little local book mouse and pounce on a copy.
Okay. Well, bless your heart. Thanks.
Be well.
Bye-bye, Bob. Let's go to Jerry. Jerry's with us from St. Louis.
Hey there.
Hi, Jerry. How you doing?
Just fine. I've been to here... You talk when you were in St. Louis a time or so ago, and you talked about research you'd done for Lamb and for Fluke. And so I was wondering, what kind of research, if any, did you put into this book?
Well, as I said earlier, Jerry, it was sort of a lot of the research was observing people while my mother was passing and while my girlfriend's mother was passing and seeing how people around death reacted. So I actually had conversations that I took notes on, and I was sort of probably pretty obnoxious just being the guy who was trying to see what was going on around the whole process, as well as being very directly involved in it. So there was not the kind of research where I went to Israel for Lamb or I went out and lived with whale researchers for Fluke. I did spend a lot of time wandering around San Francisco because the book is very much a part of the city is very much a part of how the book is told. And in that, I would just, you know, go hang out in Chinatown or North Beach or Russian Hill or, you know, the Mission and the different neighborhoods to get a feel for those, because the city really very much becomes a character in the book. And but it was a different kind of research than what you heard about with Fluke or Lamb, because it wasn't so much academic research. I read all the, you know, the sort of greatest hits of death, the Egyptian Book of the Dead and the Tibetan Book of the Dead and, you know, the Book of the Grateful Dead. And it pretty much just so that would inform the book. But it turned out that my experiences watching real people pass away was what informed the book more than anything.
Thanks, Jerry.
Okay, thanks,
Jerry.
Thank you much.
Bye-bye. And one last call, if we can squeeze it in. Steve. Steve from Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Hi, Steve.
Hello. I was in Maui in February reading Lamb on the beach and laughing out loud, and the guy next to me was laughing reading a book, and we passed the books to each other, and he was reading Coyote Blue.
Love to hear that. I love to hear that. I've never seen that out in public, but it's great to hear that people, other people do.
Yeah, I bought Coyote Blue and just started reading it now. Love your work very much.
Oh, thank you so much.
Except I think he would tell you this trading of books, not a good thing. Go out and buy your own copy.
We bought our own.
Oh, good.
Bless your heart.
We passed it to each other to see what the other one was reading.
Ah. They make great gifts, you know.
Oh, I know.
Okay.
And Christmas, Father's Day, something's coming up soon. So
absolutely.
couldn't be more perfect. Steve,
thanks
very
much
for the call. And Chris Moore, what's your next book?
My next one, I'm doing another vampire story called You Suck, A Love Story. And it also takes place in San Francisco. And then I'm going to do a historical comedy. So
Historical comedy?
Yeah, I think it's time for me to take on Shakespeare.
Aha. Uh-huh. So sonnets. It's all going to be an iambic pentameter,
that's,
I'm sure.
Yeah, pretty much. That's what I'm figuring. I mean, I need to learn that. But, you know, there's always research.
There's always research. Christopher Moore, thanks so much for being with us. We appreciate your time. Good luck with A Dirty Job.
Thanks so much, Neil. Take care.
Christopher Moore joined us from the studios of our member station in San Francisco, KQED, and he is the author of 9 novels, including, as I mentioned, the most recent is A Dirty Job. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan.
Talk of the Nation is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. You can purchase transcripts of stories you hear on this program. Visit our website, npr.org, and click on Transcripts at the top of the page. To learn more about all the books and authors you hear on NPR programs, go to npr.org/books. This is NPR.